Are you looking for a forum where you can discuss ACB Radio programming with presenters and fellow listeners? Then you may want to subscribe to ACB Radio Friends. It offers all of the same announcement material you'd receive on our ACB Radio announcements list, but in addition, it permits discussion with ACB Radio staff and listeners. To join, send a message to majordomo@telepath.com with subscribe ACB Radio-Friends in the body of the message. That's majordomo@telepath.com with subscribe ACB Radio-Friends in the body of your message. Keep in touch with ACB Radio, the station that's out of science. Welcome to Blindline. I'm Jonathan Mosen. This is the interactive talk show for the world's blind community where we speak on a range of interesting subjects. It's good to have your company, and it's extremely comforting to know that you've chosen us over the presidential debates. I have to say it's probably a wise choice, but then as somebody who will not be voting on the 7th of November, I guess I can afford to say that. On the program between now and, the next 2 hours or so, we're going to be speaking first off about the digital talking book and, in fact, digital special format revolution, because while many people think that the digital revolution taking place in special format libraries is all about talking books, it's about much more than that. Special format material production is becoming more exciting and hopefully more easy. We'll tell you more about that shortly. And then, of course, we'll have our open forum part of the program. Some of the things that you may want to talk about in that part of the program include the Americans with Disabilities Act under threat. The U.S. Supreme Court is going to be considering states' rights and where they interface with the Americans with Disabilities Act. How do you think that is going to go, given the composition of the Supreme Court? What does it mean if you have a situation where state governments are going to be required to be less strict than the private enterprise businesses in the United States? We'll talk more about that later. Time now to introduce to you our guests, though, and Rosemary Kavanagh is the Executive Director of the Canadian National Institute for the Blind's Library for the Blind, and she also chairs the Section of Libraries for the Blind group in the International Federation of Library Associations, known as IFLA for short. Rosemary, it's a pleasure to have you on the program today.
Thank you.
And Jerry Chevalier is a self-employed software developer, but he also serves as a volunteer on the CNIB's Library Board of Directors. He's also a CNIB client and library user, and there's nothing like being a user of the service to really focus the mind on changes and improvements that are up and coming. So, Jerry, thank you very much for getting on the ball and initiating this program this afternoon.
It's my pleasure.
Let me start with you, Rosemary, and ask you to tell us a little bit about the components of the new digital library that you launched back in this gala reception in September, because I understand there are three broad components that you've launched.
Yes, the three broad components are part of what we call our national network, VisionNet Canada. And when we developed the vision around VisionNet Canada, we recognized that one of the most challenging issues facing blind people the world over and libraries for the blind was the lack of content. I don't think that enough attention had been paid, although I guess people knew that in a realistic kind of way. But nobody had really paid attention to the fact that the information gap, which we all acknowledge to be wide, was probably wider and deeper than was recognized. So in our vision of the digital library, we recognize that the traditional methods of producing content, recording books or even brailing them, would never close the information gap. And so our vision of the digital library was to develop a set of components that would, yes, continue the transcription of books, but also enable us to harness electronic resources on the web, which is where most of the mainstream libraries are headed. And so as a result, the three components are our VisuCat, our online catalog, which is accessible nationally. And we can sign up clients from anywhere in Canada, and clients who wish to access our services independently can use that online catalog as well. And the other component is our VisioNews service, which is accessible via the web as well as by telephone. And our goal ultimately is to have accessible over 36 newspapers right now. I think we have active about between 14 and 20 newspapers. So you could be anywhere in Canada in your own community. Not only would you be able to read your own newspaper, your own local newspaper, but you'll be able to get some of the national ones as well. And the other component, which I, to my knowledge nobody has put in place anywhere else, is the VisuText component. Now, that service will assemble all of our electronic books and Braille files, and will also link many thousand sites on websites that our librarians have verified for their authenticity and appropriateness and their subject content, so that you can move quite easily between our online access catalog, between VisuText and VisuNews, and be able to access a variety or sources of information on quite a wide variety of topics. That's the essence of what we launched 2 weeks ago in Toronto internally. And I'm glad to say that many of our clients are signing up for the VisuText module.
We have a call already on the line for Rosemary and Jerry on Blind Line. Hello to area code 336. Hello there. Well, they appear to have gone, so that's fine. Let me ask you, it's easy to talk about the web and the wonderful services that it offers, sometimes harder for agencies for the blind to actually provide quality training. And this is, of course, not just a CNIB problem. Blind people around the world seem to be struggling with using computers effectively. Is this something that CNIB has worked hand-in-hand with its technology training people on when you're launching such a profoundly web-based initiative?
It's not something we have resolved, but it's certainly something that we have brought to their attention. And certainly in a recent submission that we supported to the federal government, one of the issues we raised is funding for to train clients and to provide a national troubleshooting service where if somebody's on the system, they can pick up the phone and they're having problems with, for whatever reasons, whether it's their adaptive technology or just using the system, they'll be able to pick up the phone and dial an 800 number and get some immediate assistance. That's still out there to be delivered, but it certainly is something that we acknowledge that as you move into the digital library, you have to have the training and you have to have the support for the clients.
Jerry, I presume that as a consumer yourself, as well as someone who's been designing this, you'll be using the service now, and I wonder if you can give us an impression of how it's all going.
Well, I'm very impressed. I guess one of the reasons I joined as a volunteer to help this process along was that I've always been a big fan of libraries ever since I was a youngster, and I have RP, so I was fortunate in my younger days to be able to read print, and it wasn't until after I had finished university and began to lose that ability. And now, of course, being blind, I can't read print at all. And I had always been an advocate for library services. However, I'd never viewed the library for the blind in my country as being any more than a talking book service for me or a Braille service until the mid-90s when the Internet had come of age. And I was made aware that CNIB Library was trying to engage the digital technology to offer better services to blind people. So, as a user, I can appreciate very much the fact that I can now plug in and independently without asking for assistance or having to mail in requests or phone somebody on a 1-800 line. I can independently access books. I can go to the VisuText site and explore the entire digital repository we've built up, which has already got several thousand books and about 1,000 web links, and we're now loading our Braille masters as we produce them onto that same site, so that it introduces the concept of a virtual library rather than waiting for a Braille book to be delivered in the mail to me. I could actually download it and emboss it locally or turn it back into text or whatever. And one of the things that came that Rosemary hadn't mentioned is we had produced, I think it's the first reference library service for the blind in the world, and again, that's all made available by digital technology. So I can email a request on some obscure topic to the reference librarian, which I've done, you know, many times in the cited library, and ask for a response back and information on a particular topic, and we will produce that in the CNIB library in the format of choice. So in my case, they typically will email documents or web links back to me. But we've had older people ask for information on Mexico because they were going on a cruise and they wanted some travel information, and we would record it in audio and send it back to them. So there's just an incredible resource there that is very, very enjoyable to explore.
That's our Information Resource Center. But one of the things I wanted to add as well about going digital and envisioning a future where you would link other resources is the ability to network to other libraries. And wearing my IFLA hat, I'm encouraging more and more libraries for the blind towards moving towards more standardized systems and more standardized ways of doing things, because there's a lot to be gained from mainstream libraries, and they are rich in information resources. And therefore, if we want to build a world vision of interconnected libraries, then we have to be sure that all libraries for the blind are developing the same standards. So in addition to building some of the content and taking it, as Jerry has mentioned, from electronic and web-based resources, we also want to make sure that we can link with other libraries and reduce some of the duplication involved in creating the content.
Do you have any statistics on how many blind Canadians have web access right now?
The last set of statistics we looked at, which had been a survey conducted as a result of the federal government initiative with publishers, suggested that something like 40% or more were acquiring computers. I don't know if you're on top of those statistics or remember them better than I do, Jerry, but I think it was about 40%. And we know that a substantial portion at the time that they were interviewed indicated that they would be acquiring computers as well.
Actually, I don't remember all those numbers, Rosemary, but the number I do remember was the demographic below the age of 60.
Mm-hmm.
There were 55% of our own clients below the age of 60 were already using computers to access information.
And as we go out and we host a number of client forums across the country, most of the people who attend are elderly, and we are discovering that a large number of them are themselves already using computers and using email to stay in touch with their grandchildren. And so for them, with the help of somebody in their household or a family member who is more knowledgeable about it, they're able to establish themselves on the web and to get access to the newspapers.
I should add that we are accepting calls for our guests, and if you wish to participate, this is Blind Eye. We are live from 1 till 3 Universal Time on Thursday morning. The program is replayed, but if you're listening to it at that time, that's 9 till 11 Eastern Time in the United States on Wednesday evening, then you can call in and ask a question at any time, courtesy of spiderphone.com. The number is in your title bar, but in case you don't have access to that, the number is area code 212-812-2800. That's in New York in the United States, but of course if you have technology such as MSN Messenger or similar, it's a free call from anywhere in the world. That's 212-812-2800. When you're asked for a PIN, you should enter 0480-5512. That PIN again, 0480-5512. You have a number of newspapers on your Vision News service. Presumably a number of Canadian newspaper providers already have websites. Why would people use the Vision News service as opposed to going to the provider's website directly?
Do you want to answer that, Jerry, or do you want me to answer it?
Well, we can probably both have a go at it. The difference I find, Jonathan, with we purchase a commercial encapsulation of these newspapers from a streaming server, and then we broadcast that over with synthesized voice, so that we're having full content of the paper, including the entire articles, and not abridged or summary articles that you get on a lot of the websites. But it is true that there is, for people who are skillful, they can glean a lot of information from the newspaper websites. But our clients, especially the ones who aren't using computers and only have telephone access, have a wealth of information that they wouldn't otherwise be able to get.
I like the library explanation better. We are a library, and whereas bookstores and libraries exist together, libraries organize content and make them accessible and distribute them out, and that's part of our service as I see it. If you go into any library for the general population, you can get most of the major newspapers are available there. We're doing the same thing for our clients, and as Jerry says, we make sure that the content is complete, and it's also designed to work better with their adaptive technologies. The particular service that provides that for us takes care of all of those technical issues, so it works really well for our clients and very easily.
Because Braille masters are text, presumably you already have started, and as Jerry mentioned, you're working towards having all the new Braille masters made available for instant download, essentially. Are you looking at taking the whole library that way, so that if I'm a Canadian borrower and I find a talking book that I really want to listen to, I can download the book rather than wait for it to be posted to me?
Yes, that certainly is part of the vision of and why we're building the VisuText module, which is downloadable. By the way, when we approached our vision of the library service, we didn't think that a digital library was all about just audio files. And in fact, although we work with DAISY, which I'm sure you're familiar with, we saw DAISY as creating the opportunity for us to create a single source file from which we could output Braille, audio synchronized to text, and text files. So for us, the whole, we're positioning ourselves to be able to do exactly that, to be able to download a file in whatever format people want.
Do you have any further comments on that?
As a matter of fact, we are currently producing a collection of 250 books in Canadiana, and one of the recent editions that came out of there, we actually had the Braille master, the Braille file, up and ready before the synchronized audio portion of the recording was done, so that the Braille department was able to produce the Braille book before the audio book. That doesn't happen very often in talking book libraries, so we're very pleased that for the Braille users out there, we don't expect the digital library to compromise their Braille content, rather to increase it.
That's right.
When you talk about synchronized audio, let's try and get into some of these more technical terms that people have perhaps heard around the place. With a DAISY book, it means then that when it's all up and running, you can have one CD that contains, say, a BRF file, for want of a better term, so that you can read that on a Braille display. You'll have audio and possibly the original print text complete with diagrams. Is that how it works?
Yeah.
Well, there's actually three files on a DAISY master, and you have to realize that the standard is there, but the producers can explore it to whatever extent they want. So it's still possible for a library to produce an audio only file, or for them to produce a full synchronized book. It takes much longer, and it's much more technically complicated to do the full synchronized audio. So that would tend to happen on books that are non-fiction or reference materials more than it would for fiction. But what you have is the audio files are first recorded in the studio in WAV format, and then when they're ready to produce the CD distribution master, they compress those currently into MPEG level 2. And then they also put the full marked up text, and when we say marked up, they're using HTML now, and the next release of DAISY will be moving to the XML standard. And then, so you have XML text files, you have compressed audio files, and then you have a third set of files called SMIL files, S-M-I-L, which integrate or synchronize the text to the audio so that you could theoretically move back and forth from one to the other. So as a blind person, you could sit at your computer and use your search function to search for keywords in the text, and when you find the position that you want to be at, you could instruct the software to synchronize from there and flip over and play the audio, the full human narrated audio back to you. Or vice versa, if you didn't hear the word that the narrator said, you weren't quite sure what that phrase was, you could stop at that point and flip into the text and read it out with your synthesizer or refreshable Braille display. So it's an incredible, immense tool for blind people. I mean, even the learning disabled, I'm told, would benefit from this technology, because you could theoretically scroll the text on the screen as you're listening to the narration.
It'd be also jolly good for karaoke, wouldn't it?
Yes.
Let me ask you, I'm a keen observer of all of this Daisy stuff from the sidelines, as a journalist, really, and I see that there appears to be a bit of a debate going on about whether all of the material produced in Daisy is structured or not. In other words, does an elderly borrower who's, say, 70 and reading a work of fiction really need the structured stuff, given the time it takes? Do either of you have a view on that?
I do. I think it's a question of degree, and that's what our collection development departments have to step back and analyze, which books are really really require full markup, or shall we say, which require the degree of markup. I will tell you that whenever we have demonstrated the Daisy books, our elderly clients are most enthusiastic about it, because they don't have to change tapes, they don't have to worry about switching sides, and they can skip around and move from page to page or from chapter to chapter. That's probably about all you would need with a fiction book. But it's true that marking up content is very expensive.
Do you not think, though, that if the information in terms of, let's say, page number, etc., is available to a sighted person, that if the technology exists, at least in theory, a blind person should have equal access to that same information for whatever reason? One never knows when it might be relevant.
Oh, I totally agree with that, but I know that some libraries will always make choices around what their budgets will allow. But I agree with you that our first standard is to benchmark against what's available to the sighted public. And by the way, that's where we came from in terms of our own philosophy of approaching library service. We look at what civil society accepts as the standard for free public library service, and that's what we should try to rise to.
It sounds.
I know. I was talking to our recording manager just recently, a couple of weeks ago, after the launch, and they're playing around with this whole process of how much synchronization do they do on which kind of books, and they sort of feel that they should at least have page numbers in every book, because they're developing some scripts to automatically paginate the text and put the markup in for page break, so that they can make that process relatively less labor intensive, and so I'm hoping that in CNIB, even for fiction books, we'll probably have page markup and chapter markup as a minimum, and then we'll move up from there.
Yes, we haven't addressed as yet the issue of setting standards, but we do know that that will at least be part of the basic standard. You can't just plan for the situation right now. You have to look down the road when there will be other playback equipment or ways of playing back these talking books or whatever that will require exactly that markup. And you don't want to take the opportunity away from anybody because you thought about it too narrowly in the beginning.
It seems to me like the talking book machines of the future could be any number of things, that we could be playing a special format. Or even the term talking book is probably a little bit of a misnomer, because your talking book is also going to be your braille book and your large print book, all on the one thing. But presumably a PC is going to be an option for some people. For those who just want the audio, a kind of a simple player will be another. Can we talk a little bit more about the delivery mechanism and what you see eventuating?
One of the things that we have not done at this stage, that we're avoiding at any rate for the moment, is that we have not addressed the issue of the playback, largely because we think that at this stage it's irrelevant. We first of all have to address the business of creating the content in some kind of digital format, and that's our focus, because we think the playback environment will change, and as you said, Jonathan, there will be many, many opportunities for different types of equipment and means and methods of playback. You're right, some people will use their computers, some people will be quite happy with a very simple player that allows them to skip from page or chapter or headings or whatever, and not anything more complicated than that.
And we are going to, as we build content, when we start getting a few hundred books online, we're going to offer our own clients, at least those that have computers, the ability to borrow the book, we'll master it onto CD, and then they can play it. So we'll be getting feedback from those people on initially the first allotment of books going out as to what they think of the navigation, what we've missed, what we could have done better. So hopefully that'll be an interactive process with our clients as we gain experience in the recording studio and just how to build these books.
Well, Jerry mentioned that pilot project of ours where we're creating Canadiana in all digital content, which will be, of course, digital audio, braille, electronic text, and so forth and so on. And that experience will allow us to derive some of our future strategies around how we acquire, organize, and distribute the content. It certainly is training us in terms of laying out the production process and determining which parts of a collection will be more intensively marked up than others.
Are the CNIB studios now completely digital?
No, they're not. They're getting there, but they're not. This is all part of this pilot project in terms of trying to move them from complete analog to digital. Part of that package as well is to acquire some of the existing players, and we will package a number of those digital audio books, send them out with the players to our clients, and have our clients test them and provide us with feedback as to what they do or do not like.
So what are your time frames in terms of, let's say, when your studios will all be digital and when everybody will have a DAISY-compatible player?
Our time frame that we've looked at, our strategic plan is really a 5-year strategic plan, and we hope that within 3 years we will have moved most of our studios over to being digital. We have 3 production sites across the country, and we hope to make all of those digital. We anticipate, however, that even though we may be mastering books digitally, we will be outputting at least 50 or 60% of them still in cassette format, because we have a lot of players out there, talking book machines out there, that are still are 4-track players, and we'll need to continue to support those until we phase them out. So I would say that by about the 4th year, we should be about 50% cassettes and probably 50% CDs. And the CD distribution will likely be played on computers or a player that we will choose to buy for the time being in order to support those people who don't want to use computers.
Do you have a view about a position that is out there that says that the CD is actually really a transitional type of technology, and that rather than invest a whole lot of money in CD reproduction equipment, libraries would be better to wait for some sort of solid state solution before changing the delivery mechanism?
Let me reply to that by asking a question. Which technology isn't transitional? We're always moving towards something else, but in the meantime, you have to serve people, and you serve them with what's appropriate, and you move on to something else.
I think the days have gone by when we were in the late 70s and we moved into the 4-track format, and we were able to get 20 to 25 years out of that technology. We're all recognizing that our responsibility as a producer would be to build a viable mastering format that can last for many years, and hence digital is the way of the future. As to which players come along, and that's going to be a commercial marketplace that's explored by people such as Victor and FlexTalk and others in the future. And so it's our hope to just have the capability to produce masters that will accommodate one or more players out there that are our best economic value to our clients.
But the decision of how they will listen, what formats they will accept it on, will be a client decision in any case. And what we have to worry about is getting the content into a state where they can make use of it, regardless of what device or appliance they choose to use. In other words, we're trying to be appliance independent in what we're producing.
As a client, I would agree with Rosemary. As a user of this system, a guy that's out there working and trying to make a living, or if I was going to school or to university, if you told me that you're not producing content because you think next year there would be a CD player, and then next year you say, well, we're going to wait one more year because the DVD players will be out, and then maybe flashcards, I'm going to be a very frustrated user saying, look, just give me the file and I'll figure out how I'm going to play it back. And you guys just produce this stuff. So we're very much aware that we're always going to be in a waiting game. We're going to hold off as long as possible in purchasing any volume orders of playback equipment. But at some point we'll have to make that decision, and we'll have to pick the best choice at that given point in time. But our main ramp up for the next 3 to 4 years is to produce the content, produce the masters.
Is there a certain type of material that you're prioritizing for digital delivery?
No, not at the moment at all. We're looking right now with the opportunities presented by this Millennium Project. We're trying to model a production situation that will endure for all types of content. As I said before, we know that some content won't need to be marked up as much as others, and our collection development department at the moment makes those decisions. Even with what we have now, they make those decisions. They decide what will go into Braille and how many copies, and what will be an electronic text, and what will be a talking book.
So there's a concern out there that some libraries may go one way, some libraries may go another way, and that we have these disparate digital standards out there. Can we talk a little about efforts that are being made to ensure that despite differences that exist in libraries around the world over delivery, that the actual production standard is the same?
That's one of the issues that in IFLA we are trying to address by encouraging more libraries to work together in agreeing on and designing the standards that they will use to both organize the content and produce it as well. And it is a little bit discouraging to me that I don't see as many of the large libraries for the blind being a part of IFLA, for example, which is the only place where libraries for the blind meet professionally as a group. There is no other organization where they get together as a group. And that is the main focus. It's what IFLA urges is exactly the development of those standards, so that you don't have the crazy duplication and you don't have substandards in different parts of the world.
Am I right, though, in saying that the issue is predominantly one of delivery, and that there is cooperation on standards? Because I suppose that there is a feeling with the majority of our listeners being in the US, with NLS saying that, you know, they're not going to have digital talking book players out there probably until about 2010, 2011, because they're waiting on a newer delivery mechanism, that at least people might be comforted to know that everybody's going to be singing the same tune in terms of production standards, so that no matter what the delivery mechanism is, it's pretty easy to convert that digital master to whatever delivery mechanism is being used.
I agree, but only if people cooperate in creating the standards and applying them. I would agree that's true. But there is no reason right now, if you go back to the statistics we quoted before, if those people who are below the age of 50, if over 40% of them acquire computers or use computers to access information, there's a target audience that can use CDs.
Yes. So,
or they could even use a downloaded audio book.
Sure.
It's also possible.
Well, let's talk about that, because I wonder how big a DAISY book actually is. I mean, let's say you've got your average size work of fiction and it's a completely marked up multiple format DAISY book. How big is it going to be for downloading?
Well, the one that we were playing with in the studio a couple of weeks ago when I visited the studio was 315 pages, I think, in print. and they have various choices when they record it and when they compress it as to how much space they're going to take up on the final version. But they had it down at around 350 megabytes. And I think that was about 20-some hours of recording. And they hope, ultimately, with the next release of Daisy, to get up as much as 50 hours of recording on a single CD, which would accommodate pretty much every book, fictional work that we have anyway. And in fact, it would accommodate several books in some cases. Say you had a series or a trilogy or something.
That's right.
You'd get them all on one CD. And so, as Rosemary mentioned earlier, for some of our seniors who are confused about side A, side B, side 3, side 4 in their tapes, they would have one single media delivered to them with the entire book on it, and the machine telling them how to move from chapter to chapter or page to page if they lost their place.
I think one of the big challenges that has to be faced is whether we, blindness agencies, including the CNIB, will be in the business of distributing playback equipment 10 years from now.
Well, that's a bit controversial, isn't it? Because I take it, like most places, the CNIB provides borrowers with a talking book machine at no charge. Is that correct?
That's right.
Yes, and every place we've made a public presentation and demonstrated Daisy, there's always someone that stands up and says, "Well, will you guys replace my tape player with a Daisy player when you get them?" And so there are many people that are concerned who are on fixed income and so on, and aren't using computers or don't intend to, or even if they do, they still would like some sort of portable player. So the philosophy within the CNIB still remains. We will do our best to provide, subject to the funds that we need to raise for them, of course, to provide the machines to our clients.
But then, in the past, the CNIB always, for example, provided a talking book machine to anybody who signed up, or who was signed up for the service. My question is this: if some of these people have computers and prefer to take CD books they play on their computers, will we also provide them with a playback machine? Now, that's an internal question, but it suggests to me that the distribution of free machines will need to be looked at in an environment where there may be many ways to access and bring information into your home.
Mm. And of course, it's not unreasonable to suggest that even in this day and age, somebody with a GE Handy cassette, let's say, picking one of the machines out of the number that we could, surely shouldn't be expecting to have a Telex talking book machine, because the GE Handy cassette plays them anyway, so one would think that the same thing would apply.
Yes, and some of our clients choose to buy their own machines for one reason or the other. My only point here is that with the content being less appliance dependent, the opportunities for dealing with how you access that information and how you play it back are certainly changing, to the extent that it will raise questions about when do you distribute a player and what kind of player.
There are all sorts of fun convergence things going on, aren't there? Because you've got the fact that audio compression is getting better. I realize that it's all MPEG-based at the moment, but you have this new thing called Vorbis, which is an open standard, which seems to be giving even better audio compression than MPEG and may make it into the final Daisy standard, who knows. But you also have a convergence with greater availability of bandwidth. So with those two things, smaller files, bigger bandwidth, and the convergence of the fact that your TV is soon going to become your internet appliance and everything else, it may be that people will be receiving all their talking books and, you know, listening to them on their television or some other internet appliance.
Exactly, choosing to do it that way, yes.
Or even purchasing them in commercial stores. I mean, the other piece of the paradigm shift is the commercial industry. We know that Microsoft is now looking very seriously at their, in fact, have announced that they will incorporate the Daisy standard into their future electronic talking books, so that who knows what will be out there in several years in terms of these standards being adopted in the commercial world, which again would open the floodgates for all kinds of ingenious types of players.
Let's come to some international issues, because we have an international audience on ACB Radio. Of course, last I checked, we were heard in 55 countries. One of the problems that people from my part of the world have is that we've all had our copyright laws pretty much liberalized internally, so that it's much easier than it used to be for us to produce material for our local markets. We don't have to have copyright cleared, it's automatic. But that doesn't seem to have been translated into freer international trade of special format materials. So, for example, the Library of Congress cannot provide web braille access to people outside of the US, and if I want to buy a descriptive video from the US, they don't clear copyright for outside the US, so although I can buy them from the UK, I can't buy them from the US because I'm not in the US. This is a problem, isn't it? And hopefully something that IFLA is looking at, because special format material is such a scarce and precious resource. It seems a shame that we're faced with these artificial barriers.
It's very true, and it is an international problem, because the copyright arrangements differs according to different countries. One of the projects that we certainly discussed at our last IFLA Standing Committee meeting, and I hope to be pushing that later on, is to develop our own consortia for Libraries for the Blind and forget about trying to change copyright laws. I'm not saying we should necessarily dispense with that. I think that initiative should continue. But if we wait on making those changes in every country, we'll wait forever. So what I'm suggesting is that we set up a consortia, and we haven't defined this as yet, but a consortia that will approach some of the major publishers, sign an agreement with them, so that they will provide us with, many of them are now producing the audio files early enough, both the audio files and the electronic files, and allow the consortia to make as many copies as it needs to distribute to its members, or to permit interlibrary loans between its members without a problem. I don't see that as any different to what public libraries do, which is they go to publishers, they get a particular discount, and they buy a number of copies from them, which they put on their shelves. So what's the difference? You know, we'll do the same thing. We'll pay you a fee. You allow us to make as many copies as we need to. If we want to put it in a two-track format or a four-track format or on a CD or make it into a Daisy book, then we can. And the participants in the consortia have permission to do this. Now, I realize that trying to organize that on the international scene will be quite tricky, but I think we have to start somewhere.
Let's go through that, because the basis on which the copyright changes around the world have been made internally has essentially been a right of access, saying that if something is available in print, then it should be available in Braille, and it oughtn't to be necessary to clear copyright for the Braille version or the special format version. It's a bit like saying, well, mm-hmm. this is our ramps, if you like. This is the accessibility issue that faces blind people, just like an accessibility issue faces physical disabilities. But what you're saying essentially is that we be a bit pragmatic, that we compensate in some way through an international consortium for the author's intellectual property. So we're in essence surrendering that principle that we automatically should be able to clear copyright.
No. What I'm proposing is no different from what public libraries in Canada do. They go to the publisher and they buy whatever copies they need. They do, for instance, we have processing centers here in Canada who will go to publishers and they will buy thousands of copies at a 40% discount for libraries throughout the country who take their service. What I'm saying is we do the same thing with Libraries for the Blind. We go to the publisher and we say, we will buy from you your audio master, we will buy from you your electronic file, and we'll pay, we come to an agreed price for this, and it allows us to manufacture and put on library shelves for those participating in the consortium the number of copies we need in whatever formats.
Do you think the concern about this, or the fact that we seem to have got stuck somewhere on these international issues, stems from nervousness, international nervousness, that perhaps another country's copyright laws may not be as stringent about ensuring that the special format material is really for people with a genuine print disability.
Well, that's true, and of course we would have to be able to give some assurance to those publishers that we will be able to control it. But I'm certain that they will be attracted by the fact that this is not a market from which they're currently making any money.
Right.
And that by our approaching it as a business and saying, you know, we'll buy these from you if you permit us to make as many copies for these participating libraries, will make a difference. If we waited forever to make the argument on the copyright basis, we'll still be here in the next 2 centuries, I believe. But the point is this, with the change in moving to digital, we need to get from the publishers their electronic files. And to do that, no copyright agreement is going to secure that for you in any timely arrangement.
There was talk that the World Intellectual Property Organization might be an appropriate forum to pursue these issues. Do you know anything about that organization and what its relevance might be to this debate?
Well, IFLA has certainly made a lot of submissions to them, and I know that Libraries for the Blind, within the Libraries for the Blind section, we have made representation to them, and representation continues to be made on an individual basis by different countries. I haven't seen any major results. The best results we got in Canada was when our government passed the Copyright Act, which effectively said it's not a contravention of the Copyright Act for you to make a copy accessible to somebody who is perceptually disabled. That's when it really freed it up for us. But once you get between countries trying to make arrangements so that I don't have to do one of the British books and the British don't have to do one of the Canadian books, that's where you run into problems. Or if you're trying to interlend it between countries, there is a problem.
What sort of support are you getting from your IFLA colleagues for turning up the heat on this whole international issue?
Oh, they're very supportive. They're very supportive, and we work together as the section of Libraries for the Blind, and then we work individually in our own countries. But it's a difficult one to resolve. This is why I'm suggesting that we go the route of negotiated arrangements directly with key publishers so that we get the content up front in a format that we can put straight into our production streams and produce whatever we need. And then within our own consortia, we rationalize the business of duplication. There is no point in 20 of us marking up the same book.
You see, Jonathan, as another blind person, you and I would probably say there's always a flip side to these arguments, a corollary that on the one hand, having the copyright laws is indeed important and pressure should be done to have those laws amended so that these materials are available. But there's always a perspective that when you pass these laws, it's to make an accommodation for the blind people and to help them out. On the other side of the coin, the flip side is the commercial viability of any practice by approaching the publishers as a consortia, just like public libraries do, and say, look, we want you. You've got this material, you've got electronic files, you've got electronic audio files. We need that to produce for the blind, so we'll pay you. You know, you'll get some recompense for giving us those files, and we'll work together. And that indeed would get the material out faster and get the partnerships working faster. And I think in the long run, it would put more pressure from consortiums and from exchange of materials in the commercial venue, put more pressure on the legislatures in the various countries to look at the legal issues of copyright, because now there's a whole they see a whole activity going on in the commercial arena that's happening anyway, so maybe they should build some legislation around it. So I'm all for moving ahead as fast as possible and letting publishers and authors know that there's a commercial benefit to them sharing their materials in the blind community. It's not just a case of making accommodations.
But it also makes no sense that we would be producing an audio book in our studios while the commercial producer is producing it at the same time. It makes no sense.
Presumably you can take
the cost to us.
Yeah, absolutely. So presumably you can take the bits of the master you want. For instance, there's a lot of sensitivity, it seems to me, about accents around the world. When I was in the US a wee while ago with my children, we turned on the British program The Teletubbies. I just couldn't believe that they'd actually overdubbed the British soundtrack with an American soundtrack because people said they couldn't understand the British accent. So, and some British people, by contrast, don't like their talking books being read by Americans. So is it possible to take, let's say, everything else to do with the markup and do a new audio soundtrack if that's what the borrowers wanted?
Any of those things are possible, but it should be intriguing to know that I believe it's over 70% of our clients in the profile on our system indicate that they will take any book regardless of accent.
Right.
So sometimes I sit and I wonder who plays up the accent business.
And we've actually had some requests from the American side because Toronto is the largest Canadian city. It's also very multicultural. There's many Americans who have asked whether we can get content from Canada because they've got many of our volunteers in the recording studio are from other countries and have the appropriate accents for the material they're reading. And so, I don't know, maybe in the blindness community we're not as immune to accents as some of the sighted community. I don't know. It's never bothered me to have an accent in a narrated book.
But I constantly hear that complaint. And I would like to see the statistics supporting it, because I remember it came up as an issue, and I'll tell you how it arrived at an issue with us. We were challenged as to whether if we turned down a volunteer by using the code word accent, were we discriminating against them? And it was an issue for us because we didn't want to be held accountable or liable for discriminating against anyone. And so the first step we took was we thought, well, let's check with our clients and see to what extent accents matter. And of course, when we checked in our database, we were surprised to discover that the majority of them said that they would take the book no matter what the accent was, because they really were interested in getting the book and the information first.
Let's
so
talk about
it leads you to...
Go on, there's just a bit of a delay there. Please finish.
Okay, it leads you to wonder how valid that is, and yet I know I've heard people passionately say that for elderly people, certain voices, accents do matter.
Yes, indeed. Well, that's an interesting. Maybe we'll get some calls after the interview about that in the open forum part of the program. I should add that we're speaking with Rosemary Kavanagh and Jerry Chevalier of the Canadian National Institute for the Blind. We have around about 10 minutes, and if you would like to speak to them, we are live from 9 to 11 Eastern on Wednesday evening in the US. That's 1 to 3 hours Universal Time on Thursday morning. So if you're listening to this live and not one of the replays, you can call in courtesy of spiderphone.com. Our number in New York is 212-812-2800. That's area code 212-812-2800. And when you're asked to enter a PIN, you should enter 0480-5512. That PIN again is 0480-5512. And it should be all of that displayed in the title bar. So you would do insert T if you're using JAWS and control shift T if you're using WindowEyes. That should all be there right throughout the program. Let's talk about the state of access for your VisuNet service then. You have an increasing number of interesting texts available, but given the copyright problems, does that mean that they're exclusively available to Canadian borrowers at this point?
At this point, we're saying yes, that they're exclusively available to Canadian borrowers, and that if we were to make our collections accessible to other libraries for the blind, we would be going through a careful process of ensuring that they complied with our security standards. We do have a partnership, as you might realize, with the National Library for the Blind in the United Kingdom, and we work very closely together in jointly developing our collections, and indeed have made both our services available to clients on both sides of the Atlantic. And as soon as we can finish off the configuration of both our systems, we intend to make it so that our clients can actually go directly to each of our libraries and borrow whatever they need.
And indeed, in the strategic plan, Jonathan, for our five-year strategic plan, we have identified the concept of VisionNet Canada partnership program. So internally within Canada, we are aggressively pursuing with public libraries the ability to share our collection and for them to help us with distribution so people can access the collection from their local community. And the United Kingdom partnership is the first in what we call our international VisionNet Canada partners. And once again, that's a big achievement and a lot of logistical problems to overcome to integrate two catalogs and an ocean in between. But we want to certainly, as I as a user, am encouraging Rosemary, and after all the time, you know, who else are we approaching? Does anybody else want to get on stream? So in New Zealand, is if they're knocking on the door and your abilities as president of the New Zealand Blind Association, you know, if you can work with your Library for the Blind, we want to sign them on, because as many people as we can engage in this whole concept of VisionNet and sharing collections and working together to eliminate redundant production and all the other things and setting standards, the more people that come on stream, the faster we can move the whole process along.
Well, that's good, and I gather one of the people from there is, or at least one of the people from that library is listening today, so they've probably got your message directly.
It's interesting. I raised a question before. If we can have that kind of international participation and cooperation, certainly we can eliminate a lot of the duplication, because going to digital and marking up content will be quite expensive. As I said before, we can't afford to have 20 libraries marking up the same text.
Does that mean then that there were going to be fewer special format books produced every year because of how long, how cumbersome this process is?
But I personally believe that that's the reason you have such small collections. If you look at the size of collections that's available to the general public in any major city, it is 10, 20 times larger than what's typically available for blind people living in that same city. And the reason is because it's so costly and time-consuming to produce content. So if we could rationalize it better with a few major libraries around the world, we should be able to expand the content far better than we're doing now.
Your Vision News service, we haven't talked too much about the telephone interface to that. Can we talk about that? It's all done through synthetic speech, is it?
That's right.
Well, the Vision News is a service for the talking newspapers, is in fact a website, so you can go on it with any browser and you can browse the newspapers and read them with your Braille display or JAWS or Windowizer, whatever. What we've done is we've contracted out with a software firm to produce an intermediate piece of software that allows a touch-tone phone to browse the same website. So we're using the same server,
content.
The same content, to produce two different kinds of delivery, because we've recognized that you know, the large percentage of seniors and people that don't use computers would not benefit from this service unless we provide some other way of access beyond the computer. So we plug the telephone in. Now, theoretically, the Visutex website, with its vast repositories, is also a website. So, again, with the proper resources, we could build a telephone interface into that.
And we are looking at that.
When we get our VisuCat, our online catalog, we're now in the process of moving that over to a web-based kind of delivery service, so that it's now a telnet-based service, which is problematic for some people to use, and many people are much more comfortable with a browser kind of interface. So once we make that step, again, the possibility comes that we could have the catalog online to the computer, but also to the telephone.
What sort of synthetic speech are you using for that project?
Well, you've got me on that one. I think it, I'd have to, I've listened to it and I can't remember. It sounds
like
Which one,
like for Vision News?
Yeah.
It's the one that comes with our supplier. Offhand, I can't remember that, which it is, but I know that over the next month or so, we will have a range and choice of voices.
How are the borrowers reacting to synthetic speech over the telephone, particularly if they're not computer users and therefore not used to dealing with that sort of speech?
Actually, we had a pilot project have had for the last few years going. I have never received a complaint about it, and most of the users are elderly.
We've had the reverse complaint. People have said to us, we want newspapers and magazines, but if we put them in the recording studio and record them onto audio tape, you know, they're lucky if we can get it out 6 months later. And so they said, no, just if you can't give it to me the next day or the day after, I don't want it. And so when we said that that's possible in the internet age, but it has to be done with synthetic voice, nobody objected. They said, yes, if you can give me today's newspaper tomorrow morning on the telephone, I'm here. I don't mind the voice. So we've had very, very encouraging reaction to that, people wanting to sign up right across the country.
Now, there are people who are able to make use of technology such as MSN Messenger and a number of internet telephony programs that allow you to call Canadian phone numbers at no cost. Would those people be able to get access to that service, or are there still copyright issues really that prevent that from happening at this point?
Well, first of all, you can't get access to it unless you're signed up as a CNIB client.
Right.
So even before we address the copyright issue, it would have to be something that we agree to do and are satisfied that it meets with the copyright condition. But you can't get in unless you have a password and you are properly registered on the system.
And we've moved now into this new age. We've moved beyond just copyright issues. For example, the database that serves the Vision News newspapers is a commercial database that we purchase under license for distribution to our clients. The same thing on Visutext. We've purchased a public library information database called EBSCOhost, which has over 1,000 magazines, journals, and documents about health and finance and many other things. And as the libraries purchase these things under license, our license agreement says that that's for our customer base, for our users. So we wouldn't be allowed to put that database up to open exposure on the internet.
Mm.
So these are issues that have come up in the commercial arena as well as the copyright arena.
Only unless we renegotiate the licensing arrangement to allow that kind of access, for which of course there's a cost attached. But I'm glad you raised that, Jerry, because one of the important things about looking at the way Libraries for the Blind do business is the fact that they are missing an opportunity for far greater content for their readers by not addressing some of these special electronic databases which are licensed and which the general public and other libraries use.
It sounds like a truly fascinating resource.
Again, if you had an international consortia, once again, your purchasing power and your distribution ability would increase dramatically, even under commercial license. If you had an international consortia with half a dozen libraries, you could make incredibly attractive purchases for your customer base.
One of my major concerns as chair of the section of Libraries for the Blind is really the lack of experience that I see in so many Libraries for the Blind in terms of training and knowledge about information sources and how you get at them. And instead, they tend to be very focused on the traditional way of doing business, and their assumption is always that you have to transcribe a book. And so they are not looking at the myriad of electronic databases with quite a variety and range and depth of subject content that could, in some cases, better meet that information need than transcribing a book. And many of those databases are already in electronic format.
Your core business is blindness, clearly, at the CNIB, but where do other print disabilities fit into the strategy?
The other print disabilities get served through public libraries, and in our partners program, we make our content accessible to public libraries. So if you had a learning disability or because of arthritis you couldn't hold a book, you could go to your public library and you could make an arrangement to sign up for the service, and we would serve the public library and you would get your book.
Okay. Now, if we have...
Rosemary makes a...
Go ahead.
Rosemary makes a very good point here. The traditional see, libraries for the blind in many countries have traditionally been part of a rehab agency for the blind. They've been a department within the rehab agency, and so they've focused on blindness services from the point of view of transcription. So that this whole movement into looking at other sources of information beyond transcription into Braille and audio has been something that's not top of mind for them. So that's a challenge that the IFLA people have to meet head on and try and do some education within the libraries for the blind to get them sort of thinking out of the traditional box.
We were, for example, the first service in the world to make Britannica online to its blind clients. We were also the first one in the world to make, Jerry mentioned, EBSCO Health, which is a service which provides magazines and periodical articles on any topic in an electronic format. And it's a whole new world for a lot of our clients.
Yeah.
We actually had to educate some of our clients in through our newsletter service and so on. People didn't know what to do with an encyclopedia. Those who had never had the opportunity through school or otherwise to get exposure to a lot of these kinds of services, we had to put out sort of little examples of what you would get if you type this into the search window and get people engaged in the process, because some of these concepts aren't widely known to blind people.
Well, it's been a fascinating just over an hour now, and I'm sure that most Canadian listeners who have been getting material from CNIB already know, but can you briefly summarize how somebody who is a CNIB client might find out more information about the new services that you're offering?
Well, first of all, they can either call us if you're in Canada on our 800 service, and I don't happen to have that phone number with me now, or they could visit the CNIB website and go to the library page and get our latest newsletters and information on all of our activities and services, and all of the contact information will be there.
So I can give you, for the any Canadian listeners, we always have the users, the blind users always have these numbers top of mind right now.
Yeah,
that's
true.
The 1-800 number in Canada is 1-800-268-8818. That's 1-800-268-8818. That connects to our reader services department. Or you can email the reader servicers at redserv, that's READSERV, at lib.cnib.ca.
Well, I want to thank you both very much for giving up your evening for this. It's been fascinating, and I personally just find the whole information liberation that the internet and new digital technologies are offering very exciting. So it's been good of you to spend some time with us and explain what's happening in Canada.
Well, thank you for having us as well.
Anytime. Have a good evening.
Thank you so much, John.
Bye-bye now.
Bye-bye.
We've been speaking with Rosemary Kavanagh and Jerry Chevalier from the Canadian National Institute for the Blind, and you will now hear them ringing off. Look at that. Off they go. And this is Blind Line on ACB Radio Mainstream. I'm Jonathan Mosen. We now have around about 50 minutes or so for you to talk back on that issue or anything else that you care to raise. It's an open forum, so anything goes. What's on your mind? My number, if you'd like to participate, is area code 212-812-2800. That's in New York, area code 212-812-2800, and then into the PIN 0480-5512. That PIN again, courtesy of spiderphone.com, is 0480-5512. And it's really exciting to hear about what's going on with digital talking books and other technologies as well. Libraries really, I guess, as the rather cliched saying goes these days, looking outside the square, thinking about ways that blind people can get access to a whole range of information, presenting it in one accessible place. And it seems to me that the CNIB really have got a fantastic thing going there. And also encouraging to hear Rosemary Kavanagh talking about international efforts to make sure that all of the special format material can be shared rather than needlessly, and I hasten to add, senselessly duplicated. So, makes a body proud, doesn't it? It's now, as we broadcast live, 8 minutes past 2 Universal Time on ACB Radio Mainstream, and please get in touch. Well, what can we talk about today? I wonder how the President's debates are going. Have you tuned in late? Have you had enough of the president debate. How did it go? And one thing, if you happen to be listening to this program now, but you were listening to the first presidential debate, I'd be interested in your thoughts as to the degree to which a radio listener may have a different verdict on the debate, come up with a different winner, from a TV watcher. All the history books that I've read, and I did, for whatever reason, major in US politics as an undergraduate, indicated that in 1960, if you listened to the debate, you were more likely to think that Nixon won than if you had watched the debate, where because of appearances and visual gestures and confidence and things, you were more likely apparently to think that Kennedy had won in those famous 1960 TV debates. I was interested to listen over the week to the criticisms that have been levelled at both candidates, and in particular the comments that Al Gore had been making too many sighings and being a bit petulant. I must say that I didn't really pick that up in the audio, but clearly it was evident, and it has annoyed some people, so I wonder how he's going as we speak in this debate. I'll have to check it out on the web afterwards. But with under a month to go now, it's going to go to the wire, it looks like, that presidential race. So if you have any comments on that, how the campaign is going, and where disability is factoring into all of this, if anywhere, you're most welcome to give us a call at area code 212-812-2800. And then enter the PIN 0480-5512. That PIN 0480-5512. And good evening to area code 501.
Hi, Jonathan. This is Noel.
Hi, how are you? How's the arm getting on?
Oh, it's okay. It's getting better and able to type a little bit, so that's good.
Yeah, for those who don't know, this is DJ Nerve from HCB Radio Interactive, who does the Celtic Source, although my synthesizer keeps saying Celtic Source, so I have to keep checking myself every time I say it. He was unable to be on the internet radio last weekend because he broke his arm and couldn't do all the DJing with one hand, so it's nice to know you're on the mend.
Yeah, and went to the doctor, and it's a full arm-length cast, and so it's a lot more stable and a lot less painful, so that's good.
I'm pleased to hear that, but at least the good thing is that in the process of this experience, because you have to find a silver lining in every cloud, don't you, and you've got to learn all about dictation software.
Yeah, and I was going to, two things I was going to talk about. I was going to talk about the dictation software, which I'm using, Dragon Naturally Speaking, and it's amazing what it can do. At the rate that I'm speaking now, it will dictate almost word for word. And I say almost because it messes up sometimes. And do it, you know, with a reasonable accuracy. And for people that can't type very fast or are lazy and don't need to type, if you just plug headphones into your synthesizer and talk into your microphone, you're on the, you know, being able to type. And it's really, really quite neat.
Now, you're a JAWS user, so how does Dragon Naturally Speaking interface with JAWS without those apparently very effective but quite expensive scripts that are out there on the market?
Well, I don't use scripts for Dragon. What I do is I basically go into the software. There are hotkeys, and a lot of the commands that you navigate Dragon with change things on the screen. Like, you can, for instance, move the mouse around on the screen, or like, for instance, I could say click start, click program, click Microsoft Messenger, and it will open up Messenger for me, and then I can do any thing. I guess scripts could make it easier, but I think it's quite usable with JAWS without the script.
But then what happens if you're, say, composing an email message and you start chatting away and Dragon gets it wrong? Do you just have to go back and correct it with the keyboard, or how do you handle that?
Well, what you do is what I do is I continually monitor the screen with my PC cursor, or in Windows with just the cursor. And if it's messed up, if it's made a mistake, or I'll just dictate the whole thing and go back and check it. And if it's made a mistake, then I just say correct whatever phrase, like if I said ACB radio and it said ACP radio, then I would say correct ACP radio, and then I can just say ACB space RADIO. And what it does is it puts your phonetics and how you say it into the training dictionary, and it gets it right. So I've got ACB radio so that it does it correct every time now.
Groovy. And how much does it cost, if I might be so bold?
The cost for Dragon, naturally speaking, is $199.95 U.S. And we got it through the Union Bookstore, the department, my department at school. And it comes with a microphone headset, which is really good for me because it's hard to hold a microphone. And so it comes with a headset, and you just put it on and speak into the microphone, and it translates for you.
Okay, now you have to train this thing. So how did you get on with the training session?
It's actually pretty interesting. What I did was I took used a JAWS cursor and slowed the speech down, and I was able to listen and talk at the same time and basically copy what it was saying on the screen. I read Charlie and the Chocolate Factory, a little excerpt from that, and read about 5 minutes of that, and it was fully trained. Now, I did a little bit more training after that just because it was making some errors. But it's really neat because once you get to the end, it just automatically twitches in the next passage, the next paragraph.
I like the concept of mic TV. Mic TV, and he it's where you could watch a TV commercial and get the chocolate bar off the TV screen, a little piece to sample it, and then Mike TV decided that he'd put himself through the...
Yeah. That would be so cool.
Yeah, wouldn't it just?
That would be absolutely cool.
There's some interesting technology that they're trying here, I'm sure it's been in the US already, well, maybe not, called Teledots. And apparently you put this... It's a competition, and it makes you watch a TV program, and you put this dot on the screen that you buy at a service station and stuff. And the longer you watch the program... the bigger the dot gets and reveals eventually whether you've won a prize or not. But you have to watch the program, and you have to have the dot on the screen, and it somehow detects whether you're watching the program or not.
That's interesting. I'd never heard of that. And it would definitely be something to check into.
Yeah, man. And what was your second thing that you wanted to talk about?
Well, yesterday I was told that I might have an opportunity... And I don't know if others can comment on this, because I just wanted to ask you, being from the area, but, well, it was the day before yesterday, I was asked if I would like to go to Australia at Newcastle and study for a semester in chemical engineering, which is my discipline, at some point, you know, pretty soon, like maybe next semester or the semester after. And I didn't know if... I have a guide dog, and I know that they've relaxed the restrictions, but can you tell me a little bit about services in that area and what I might, you know, would it be possible to do this?
Well, I guess asking me about Australia is a bit like me asking you about Canada. I'm not quite sure what the restrictions might be in terms of quarantine. Certainly in this country they are very strict, but I don't know whether they're any less strict in Australia. Now, I think Newcastle, it's not the largest part of Australia. What else can I tell you? I mean, you know, they're likely to have your standard set of services that you would come to expect. I mean... But perhaps somebody who's from that part of the world may be listening. I've got a feeling that Jeff Shang might not be too far away from there. I could be totally wrong. My geography's not the best, but might be worth trying to ask him.
Right. I just was curious as far, because I've seen some things as far as that they've relaxed the restrictions for service dogs. And if you have the certain paperwork, then... But it would be something that I would really enjoy doing, and it would definitely expand my horizons as far as that goes.
I'm sure you'd have a lot of fun. So how long would you be out there for?
For approximately 6 months, I guess.
Wow, 6 months in Australia. That'd be a character building experience.
I have a lot of family out there, so it would be good for me because I'd get to see some of the family.
Yeah, with all due respect to my colleagues across the ditch. Yeah, oh, look, I'm sure it'd be a great experience, and you'd enjoy it. And given that you're interested in collecting all sorts of interesting music, you know, there's some great music over there in Australia.
Yes. Final thing before I hang up. After Blindline, I plan on doing a short program to test out my my right arm. With a collection of music that I have on the computer. Since I can type now, I wanted to do a little test drive of my my injured arm. So if anyone would like to listen, I'll be on the ACB Radio Interactive server for a short amount of time, a couple hours maybe, and like to hear comments about what you think.
It's great to be able to say that DJ Nur is no longer armless.
That's true, but I still like the one-handed DJ or the one-armed bandit. I don't know, it's something like that.
Well, are you a Braille user?
Yes, and it's very hard to read with my left hand and just one hand. But I'm trying to force that fixed elbow, you know, the fiberglass real hard thing to read that Braille and bend down there. It's just to bend my dimensions kind of difficult to do, but it's working out.
Oh man, well I wish you all the best, and people can tune into the interactive server for an unscheduled treat after Blindline. So I hope you have a really good evening, and we'll hopefully look forward to hearing you over the weekend.
Alright, and I'm on between 1200 and 1600
UTC. Good on you.
Saturday.
We'll look forward to it.
Thanks.
See you later. Bye.
Bye.
ACB Radio Mainstream. Hello, this is Blindline.
Good evening, Jonathan. This is Chris Dale from Alabama.
How are you? Good to hear from you.
I'm doing fine. I finally got MSN Messenger up and working. If you ever get a new computer, it's so much fun to transfer from your old Pentium 75 to a Pentium 3. Of course, you know, I'm not complaining. I'm finally beginning to see the payoff of the new processor.
Well, yeah, I just need to say you're actually very faint, and I've had to crank my headphones right up, so if you're able to get a little bit more volume out of the recording control volume, that would be nice, but I can still hear you. I can still hear you just. So, if you're not running a Pentium 75 now, what are you running?
I'm running the Pentium 3. I finally... I'm adjusting the mic control. Is that helping anything? MSN Messenger, I've got it up to 100%.
And that's in the recording properties, not the playback one?
That's what I'm doing, yeah.
Okay, well, it's still quite faint, but I can hear you, so that's all right.
Okay. I was just calling to basically mention that looking forward to joining you up on ACB Radio Interactive. We finally got Outscoot and Shoutcast performing correctly.
Well, we're looking forward to that too, because we're gradually expanding the schedule, and in the next couple of weeks we've expanded it just a little at both ends, and we intend to continue to do that. So that sounds really good, and I know you've been working hard on getting the whole Otsuke thing working.
Yeah, I have. For some reason, Otsuke and Shoutcast didn't want to cooperate, and I actually found out it was my error. I didn't have the playback microphone selected. It was actually a situation where if you hit a letter M, for example, for the microphone, it would highlight microphone. However, you've got to root your JAWS to PC and select that microphone with the mouse, or you may be able to get away with it with a space bar, but just just hitting the letter M and landing on microphones not gonna do it, I found out.
Yeah, as long as you have what you hear, if you've got a Sound Blaster Live selected in recording controls, you can then mute and unmute the microphone by making sure that the volume is set, you know, roughly between 70% and 80% in playback, and just unmute that checkbox with the space bar whenever you need to talk.
Right, yeah, I guess that's why quickly learned that we're amateur DJs, isn't it?
Oh yeah, man. You know, I think it's fantastic the quality of the product that's coming out on ACB Radio Interactive. There are some very determined and accomplished broadcasters out there. Some of them not doing it professionally, but they just have a natural instinct for the medium. So it's going very well.
All right. Sounds good. I know the conditions are not communication quality is not good, so I'll keep it brief. But I thought the interview on CNIB was excellent. I'm hoping that the sign up services can be a little more freely accessed, as far as maybe copyright issues can be dealt with a little bit better. And I'm not saying abolish copyright, don't get me wrong, but maybe there's some way that, you know, they can be dealt with as far as from one point to another point, from point A to point B, I guess, for lack of a better word. But good show, and sounds good, and I certainly wish the best. And if you get a slot open, we'll see if we can help out up there. I'm sort of a night owl myself. I don't know if you gathered that or not, but we've been running some pretty late night tests, and apologize for sending an email to you that Sunday night. I was just not able to make that test.
Not a problem at all. I understand.
Monday night.
Yeah, that's fine. Well, I'm pleased that you've got. So what speed is your Pentium 3, by the way?
Pentium 3, 733 megahertz is what the box said.
Goodness me, you'll be what a heck of a contrast. Yeah,
and you know, I remember, Jonathan, I remember the days back when a Pentium 75 in its time was a wonderful machine, and I thought a 1.2 gigabyte drive was, you know, the greatest thing since, as we said in the U.S., sliced bread. But, you know, things have come along. This is a 15 gig, so I can hold all, I can hold a good many op files.
Well, you know, I remember the first PC I think I had. On a regular basis, I'd used PCs before, but it would have been, I think, 1987 or something, and it had a 20 meg hard disk, and 512K of RAM, and I thought that was really cool, you know. Well, put old Procom and Telex and stuff on there, and it's amazing.
I remember Telex. When I was back in the, as we call this in the U.S., Devil's Operating System, or DOS, but Microsoft still gets, I may get email letters, but nevertheless, remember Telex and Procom, they were great programs, and I know Procom and Telex for Windows is still out there, I think, but they used to be on CompuServe, and they had a lot of good forums and a lot of good databases out there, but since everything has gone to the internet, I think the only biggest competitor between the ISPs right now is AOL. And I look for AOL participants to sort of drop off in the next 10 years and ISP participants to increase. I may be wrong, but that wouldn't be the first time today. Jonathan, I'll say good evening to you. I'm sure you've got other callers, and I certainly appreciate it.
Well, good to hear from you, Chris, and we'll keep in touch.
Thank you, sir.
Okay, bye now. There we go. This is ACB Radio Blind Line, and if you'd like to give us a call, the number is area code 212-812-2800. That's area code 212-812-2800. And when you're asked for the PIN, enter 0480-5512. That's 0480-5512. Hello to area code 336.
Hi, John. It's Jess from North Carolina.
Hey, Jess from North Carolina. How's it going?
Not bad.
Hey, aren't the president's debates in your part of the world tonight?
Excuse me?
Aren't the debates, the presidential candidates' debates, somewhere near you?
Yep. They sure are. They're on TV right now. I cannot believe my mother is actually listening to them things. Man, I'd rather be here.
Oh, well, good. Well, you know, if you run across Al and George, you know, give them a shake both their hands for me.
Yeah.
You never know, you might be able to get some sort of subliminal message through to them. Oh, I'm sorry,
I was gonna, it's not really a specific thing I wanted to talk about, but, what was I gonna say? Oh, yeah. I was looking over some, emails about, using one app with the, LineRec plugin with, Otsu, you know? You know how, Doug Huntsteer does it?
Oh, yeah, he's a cool dude.
Yeah, I gotta tell you, if you have Otsuke's compressor if you have it enabled, and you have WinApp running through Shoutcast, if you're using WinApp for Shoutcasting, and you have it on what you hear or that post mix input control on some other sound cards, I tell you, it is brilliant. I mean, just the way you can actually switch to WinApp and hit Shift V to fade it down, and then go switch right back to Otsuke, and you know, just load up the next deck or a song, whatever.
Yes, well, I suppose it's just a different technique, because you can do that by having the Windows volume control open and just unmuting the microphone. But of course, the advantage of actually turning off Otsuke's compression and letting Audio Stocker do it is that that also has an effect on the microphone, so that your microphone gets compression too that way.
Well, yeah, actually, I do. I now use Audio Stocker. It's pretty good. If you actually use it with the WinAmp with the what you hear, if you actually use it with the advanced controls, it's actually a lot better, because you can actually if you're playing a bed or something like that, you can actually turn on the music a little bit and fade the mic back up and stuff like that.
Yeah.
But the specific thing I really wanted to discuss tonight was Napster. I mean, what is the deal with that? I know they're getting shut down sometime, but I don't know when. They haven't really set a date for it yet.
No, well, what happened really was that the recording industry took Napster to court, and there was an injunction that was going to shut Napster down pending the rest of the proceedings, and that was overturned. And so far the court action goes on, and so does Napster. It will be, the legal arguments in that case are extremely interesting, and I would be really surprised if they didn't get shut down eventually, though.
Yeah, and people have to realize that, you know, they're saying all this stuff about Napster. People getting MP3s legally and, you know, illegally and all that stuff, and the record companies being shut down. But they don't, you know, they fail to realize that people have to actually go out and buy the discs or the CDs to actually make the MP3 files, to actually encode them into MP3s. And that you can actually get more songs from Napster, say, I don't know about here in New Zealand, there in New Zealand, but in the U.S., you can't go out to a music store and buy something from the 60s. I mean that's outdated as far as CD stores are. You know, and that's where MP3s and Napster and stuff comes in handy.
Well, it is true that there is some material that's really rare that's popping up on Napster, but then you see, if one person goes out and buys the album that an artist has just produced, encodes all the tracks into MP3 files, and then puts them on Napster for 7 million people to download, well, the artist's out of pocket, isn't he?
Well, yeah, and he's not really getting any money off of it either. So I guess there's a pretty good point there. But hey, if they think, if the court thinks it's hard to shut down Napster, wait till they hear about Freenet. I don't know if you've heard of that or not.
Yeah, I have. I mean, that's the thing, you see. Somehow, we have to wrestle with this problem in a wider context, and I do agree about that, because, you know, if it's not Napster and MP3, it's going to be something else in Vorbis in the next little while, and Vorbis is going to be even more interesting, because a Vorbis file of the same bitrate sounds even better than an MP3 file, so it's going to get less and less easy to say that the compressed file sounds worse than the CD.
Yeah, and the thing about Freenet is if you're going to shut that thing down, you're going to have to go and shut down every computer that's got the software on it. I actually heard that from the inventor of Freenet. You're going to have to go and shut down about 70,000 computers.
Yeah.
I mean, that's ridiculous right there.
Well, Nutella's the same, because of the fact that there's no central point. It's a living network, and the network kind of grows and contracts based on who's connected to it. So you're right. Picking on Napster is a temporary solution. But what is the solution? I mean, if people produce great music and then they don't get compensation for it, you know, what's the solution? I'm wondering whether the solution is that the record companies may have had their day. Maybe what we're seeing is some sort of conglomerate websites like mp3.com, where you can either pay for or download the music. You get some sort of rights to it. But even then, some of this rights management stuff doesn't seem to have really taken off either.
Yes, it hasn't. I agree with you there, because I can see that already. Internet radio is going to take over commercial radio. MP3 and what is going to become Vorbis, well, is already Vorbis, is going to, soon, it's going to take over CDs. I mean, 15 years from now, you're not going to even know of, you know, future generations are not going to even know of compact discs.
No, you're right, because people will be able to download. I mean, you look at this, if you are on the PC audio list, so you've probably seen the references in the last day to this player that has 6 gigabytes, I think it is, of storage, and you can rip directly to the player from an audio CD. But eventually, you'll be able to connect that to a DSL line and just download the music you want and carry it around in your personal player. And there may well be some sort of central repository, a bit like the mp3.com Beemit thing, which the record company so stupidly objected to.
Yes.
All your music is in one place, and you just download the music you want when you're going on a particular holiday. You've paid for it, you just download it and store it in your personal player. I mean, CDs are clearly on the way out.
Yes, exactly, and I think that that people, you know, they need to realize that, hey, you know, and even the record companies need to realize that, hey, someday we're not going to be in business, and, you know, maybe we should just embrace Napster and all of these other file sharing programs. I mean, if they're going to get rid of Napster, why not they just get rid of CDs, mini disc, I mean, all that, you know? Why not they just trash everything that deals with music stuff, the record companies feel like that.
The problem is that sure, the record companies are protecting their patch, but I also have some sympathy with the artists who, having come up with a brilliant song, want to get compensated for it. And I don't think that's unreasonable. They've got to make a living somehow. And so we've got to find a model that makes sure that, you know, sure that the greedy record companies, I've got no problem with them being taken out of the picture, but the artists deserve compensation for their intellectual property, though.
Yes, they do.
And that's what's wrong with
Napster.
That's what's wrong with Napster. There's no way for the artists to get compensated for their intellectual property. And you can understand a group like Metallica getting upset when
Metallica. Metallica. I actually saw the whole deal with Napster last night on the news, and the Metallica guy actually came on the television and said, "Hey, you know, I never was asked if I wanted to put my songs up for Napster to download. I was never asked if I wanted to get Napster, you know, I was never actually asked, hey, can we put your songs up on our website, our server for you to download? I was never asked that." And he was pretty upset about that.
And I can understand that. Because you see, the trouble is the kind of people who use Napster, you can bet that a lot of them are taking that music and either burning it onto audio CD for their own custom compilation, or they're putting it onto a Diamond Rio or a Nomad or something, and they're taking it everywhere. And they have not paid for that music. They have no moral or legal right to have that music. That's the problem.
Yeah. I mean, if they're going to download MP3s, you know, they ought to pay something like, I don't know, 50 more bucks than that, you know. But, I mean, MP3, you know, I've said it before and I'll say it now, MP3 is just the audio formats to come. This digital age is just another way for us to download the kind of music we want, when we want it, you know, where we want it. I mean, you know what I'm saying there?
I do.
Mean, I agree with you that you have to, I mean, I agree that, you know, you have to pay for it. You should have to pay for it. But, I mean, the reason that Napster was actually invented was because it was actually invented from a college student, and he heard his doormate complaining about how hard it was to actually find music available, you know, like from CDs and records and all that stuff. That's where Napster came in.
Yeah, and I think that for the music industry, what's happening with technologies like Napster, all these internet technologies and audio compression, is actually similar to what happened with the printing press, in the sense that it's democratizing the music industry. You can now, if you have good music, take it to mp3.com or set up your own website and put it out on the news groups that it's there. You don't need the permission of some guy in a suit somewhere to think that your music has commercial potential. You can market it to those people who want to hear it, and this is where the record companies have got their nose out of joint, as well as the legitimate intellectual property argument. They are a dinosaur of another era.
Yes, they are. I don't know. I guess it's about all that I wanted to cover.
Well, it was very lucid, and I hope that you have a good evening in the presence of your would-be leaders.
Yes.
How
old?
Old do you have to be to vote in America?
You have to be at least 18.
Do you?
I hate that.
Oh.
Yes, you have to be at least 18.
Oh, so who would you vote for if you could?
Bush.
Why?
Because, I don't know. I mean, not to get, like, too personal or anything, but Gore just seems like a phony to me. I mean, he just seems like a fake. I mean, he doesn't really have... I noticed on the presidential debate that he, he actually spent more time... He actually spent more time complaining about, you know, sabotaging Bush's campaign than he did talking about his own governmental plans.
Right.
His own plans for president.
that's interesting, isn't it? So what do you think about those issues from the point of view of, you know, your future education, or what sort of future you're going to have, or do you look at it more from what it means as a blind person, or how do you kind of make up your mind?
I view it... I never thought we'd ever have this conversation, but anyway.
I just find it interesting to find out how younger people are looking at this election.
Oh, yes. Yes. To answer your question, I look at it as my future, as in the way my future will progress and the way our generation's future is going to progress. As I just said, Bush, I believe Bush has it pretty well thought out. You know, I mean, he's got a better, more suitable plan than Gore. I mean, he's already winning more votes than Gore is.
Yeah, well, certainly the polls are interesting. Bush seems to be consistently trending up, which is one factor that seems to be consistent. Anyway, it's very nice to hear from you, and we'll look forward to hearing you on the air this weekend.
Hey, if nothing else interferes, I shall be on the air, and you probably already know what time. Before I leave, what are you? Are you going to vote for bush or what?
Well, I have to tell you that here in New Zealand we don't get a vote on such matters because we've got our own government.
Ah, must be pretty nice.
Well, we had our election last year and I was actually a candidate. So, yeah, it's nice. We haven't got an election for another 2 years.
Mm. Yeah, and the problem is with us in the U.S. is that we, like, we don't directly vote for the president. We actually vote for electoral college
yes.
people.
Yes, yes, indeed. And what will be very interesting is with such a close election, whether the popular vote is different from the electoral college outcome. That will be most interesting to watch.
Yeah, that will. Anyway, John, good lucid, good lengthy conversation there.
Yes.
And
yes.
if nothing else, and if nothing else, I shall be on the air.
Okay, man. Well, we'll look forward to that.
All right, man.
Okay. Bye.
All right. Dr.
Lear. So, yeah, this is Blind Line. Hi to area code 706.
Well, good evening, John. Jonathan, I should say.
Well, that's right, I've been called worse.
I try not to take liberties with people's names, and I just did it, so I apologize.
Oh, well, forgiven. Forgiven, absolutely.
So, was the topic tonight? I just came in late, actually.
Have you been watching the debate?
No, I didn't get a chance to. I was visiting someone's house, and we were looking at a video, so I wasn't the one in control of the television. So.
Oh, that's outrageous. Well, we've been talking, we had a couple of guests on from the Canadian National Institute for the Blind, and talking about their fantastic new digital library initiative called VisuNet, VisuNet Canada, and we looked at issues surrounding that. And in the open forum, we've been talking about everything from Napster to the presidential debate, to, what else? Oh, Dragon Naturally Speaking and how that works, all kinds of things, really. We haven't really got stuck on one particular subject tonight, but with less than a month to go to the election, we're sort of starting to tease people out about how they're feeling about the campaign.
Well, if I got into it a lot, I'd probably nominate my cat for president or something.
What about Socks the Cat?
Socks and the Cat. I'm not familiar with that one.
Well, that's your president's cat, I understand.
Oh, is it?
Yeah.
Hmm.
I got
president than the one that's presently in office.
I had to laugh because I was watching Larry King the other night, and they played an extract from one of the debates between Hillary Clinton and her opponent, whose name just escapes me, the Republican man. Oh, anyway. And he made some sort of comment to her being a resident of Motel 1600, which I thought was rather pointed.
Okay. Anyway, I guess I'm just curious. It's kind of funny. I guess the people on Blindell, that's really about the only list I'm on other than the GW Micro list.
But, yeah.
Have you heard much flack about eVoice? When they change their services?
I've heard that there have been rumblings, but none of the lists I'm on have really made too much noise about it. I understand they're charging, $4.95 a month or something now for their premium service?
Right. What they're basically doing is cutting back the 800 usage. I think you get, if you don't pay for the service, you get 30 minutes per month, and if you do pay the $4.95, you get 1,000 minutes of 800 access and unlimited access on the local numbers. But I never got into the eVoice thing. There were some people I knew that were really into it, and so they had a lot to I understand there was a lot of talk on eVoice. There were a lot of messages about different people's feelings. From what I understand, there were a lot of blind people that became rather enamored with eVoice and suddenly are very upset because eVoice is kind of pulling the plug. And I can understand their point of view. I mean, they were all these inbound watch lines. You don't get those for free, even though it's a free call to the person dialing the number. So I did wonder how they were going to go about revenue generating, and I have to say that I was not a bit surprised when they changed their policies. In fact, their policies to me still seem a little bit liberal. I don't see how they can get 1,000 minutes for $4.95. I don't see how they can that can pay for that's less than 0.4 of a cent close to half a cent a minute if you look at it that way.
They must be banking on people not using anywhere near that. I mean, 1,000 minutes a month is a lot of minutes.
Yeah. I'm not sure. What's the monetary unit there in New Zealand?
The dollars and cents, but they're different dollars and cents from the American ones.
No, I realize that. The Australian dollar is too, the Hong Kong dollar. Let's see, how many nations are using the dollar now?
Yeah, it sounds like quite a few. We used to have a system of pounds, shillings, and pence. So you had, it was before my time, before I was even born, but I think you had like 12 shillings in a pound or something. No, was it 20? I have no idea. But it was all based on units of 12.
It was 20.
Yeah, probably. Well,
the British was 20, I think.
Okay, well, then I'm sure we were similar.
In fact, I'd like to get a table, just for curiosity's sake, showing what the different denominations were as far as that goes, because I've heard talk about half crowns and crowns and that sort of thing.
So that's right. Yeah.
Do a search on the internet or something like that.
Yeah, we had all of that. And then in 1967, we went decimal, and there were all sorts of debates about what we should call our currency, and I think they talked about the Kiwi and, oh, all sorts of other really fascinating names. I was actually reading a biography a few weeks ago of a former Prime Minister of New Zealand who was the finance minister at that time in charge of the transition, and they had all sorts of wacky ideas. I think the Tui might have been one. It's a native bird of New Zealand. But in the end, they went with dollars and cents.
Yeah. It's kind of, I guess, taken on. That's another question. I think I'll go to, let's see, Ask Jeeves. I've never tried that. I ought to just try that and see what kind of answers I get from it or whatever. One thing I'm curious about, I just need to, I guess, read the facts or whatever, but maybe you can quickly run this by me here. On the ACB Radio Mainstream, when there's not a program going on, you replay shows from the past week. Is that how you usually do it?
What happens is that we broadcast a minimum of 2 hours on a weekday, and then they rotate for a 24-hour period until the next 2 or 3 hour segment comes on. Yeah.
Yeah, I just wondered when I could catch, if there was any time that I could catch Main Menu other than waiting for it to be put up on the archive, I guess.
Yes, there is. So what happens is Main Menu starts for the first time at 9 p.m. Eastern, although when you guys go back an hour, it'll be 8 p.m. Eastern, obviously. And that goes for 2 hours, and then it just replays on Mainstream for a 24-hour period. So, in other words, you'll hear it start at 9, 11, 1, 3, 5, 7, etc., right around the 24-hour clock.
Oh, so it's gone now until it goes up on the archive.
Yeah, it's there on the archive now, though.
The one for this past week?
Yep.
I have to check it out. It seems like sometimes they've been a bit late, but then I may just have my dates wrong.
Oh, they are late. I mean, I just put it up there a few hours ago, but it's there now. And the other thing is, too, that what I often find is that depending on people's browser settings and a whole lot of other variables, sometimes with those archives pages that get updated regularly, you do need to refresh the page by hitting the F5 key. And
I use links.
I use links
so it doesn't store all that junk, temporary internet files. And I think I have Windows. I did have Windows set to delete those every time I start up the computer, and I need to go back into there and do it again. I'm waiting to hear John Mattioli's demonstration of Narrator, although I don't know if he gets into it this week or not.
Well, I don't know for certain, but he's given me Program 3, and I think it's the last one, so I think he will be doing Narrator this week. That gives me a good opportunity to say that we've got a quite long review/play with OpenBook version 5 this week on Main Menu.
Okay, I shall give that a listen, because that's something I'm always interested in. I don't have a scanner yet, but it's always something to think about.
Are you going to be doing any more quality Linux stuff, tutorial type things?
Not at the present. I haven't really been able to think of anything that I could concisely put down into it. A lot of the stuff with Linux is some of it's distribution dependent, and some of it's just a matter of compiling programs, and there's not a whole lot of I guess there's some steps you can go through for things. I'll have to give that a a gander and see if there's anything I can think of. Certainly, if there is, I'll definitely drop you a line.
Excellent.
Maybe I could just ask some people if they want to, if they can think of anything they'd like to hear covered on that between me and Matt Campbell and anybody else who wants to care to take a jab at it. I can't promise that I'll do anything, what with work and other constraints, but certainly any suggestions would certainly be welcome. So if they want to contact me by email, my address is jnorton@vol.com. That's Victor Oscar Lima, VOL.com. That's better than the nordcom.org because sometimes it's a free service that I'm using to redirect that domains, and they're in the process of trying to upgrade their service, so it can be a bit flaky, although I have to say most of the time I've been able to access pages with it, and as far as I know, I haven't had too much trouble, but you had trouble sending email to it at one point.
So. What does VOL stand for? The Voice of Liberia or something?
Yeah, that's it. No, it's Voyager Online.
Yeah. Well, that's fair enough.
It's Voyager Online is what it actually is.
Oh, well, there you go. Oh, very good to hear from you, Joe, and I hope you have a lovely evening.
By somebody else. Yes, take care of yourself.
You too.
Okay, goodbye.
Okay, bye now. And it's now, let's see, 7 minutes to 11 o'clock Eastern Time, which makes it 7 minutes to 3 Universal Time as we're live. If you're listening to a replay, don't worry about that time check. But you've got time to give us a quick call. You'll get straight on. If you want to be a lucky last caller and you think, well, should I bother or not? Yes, you should, because if you call through right now, you will get straight on the air without any waiting, and you can round the show off for us. Our number is area code 212-812-2800. That's in New York City. Area code 212-812-2800, and enter the PIN 0480-5512. That PIN again, 0480-5512. I've got to tell you, it's been an amazing week and a bit weather-wise for us in Whanganui in New Zealand. It's nice to have a picturesque sort of place, a stone's throw, almost literally, from the river. But when the rain falls and the river bursts its banks, it's not quite so exciting. And last week I was wading in gumboots from the house to the studio here, to the studio building, and our garage, which is at ground level, has the networking equipment in it. It has the PABX system that drives our phone lines here, and it has the DSL modem and the network hub that supplies all the connectivity to the 6 computers that we have here. And it was getting very nerve-wracking, wondering whether it was all going to go down the gurgler. But luckily we survived that one. But I guess you pay the price for having a property close to the river. Well, it looks like we're not going to get another call in, which is absolutely fine. Let me tell you that over the next 24 hours or so, starting at midnight Universal Time, which is 8 o'clock UT, 8 o'clock Eastern Time, we've got more programming for you at ACB Radio Interactive, ACB Radio Mainstream. Goodness gracious me, ACB Radio Mainstream. Whole Note with Jeremy Hartley is along. You can also hear Infotech with Brian Hartgen talking about a cool new talking remote control. So tune into Brian's show for that. You can also hear Faith Matters with Pastor David Andrews and Cecilia Lee. Hap Holly is on Blind Spot with Marlena Lieberg, and Travel Radio with Patricia Lawrence is there too. It's coming up tomorrow on ACB Radio Mainstream, and the fun begins at 11 Universal Time on Friday evening. That is 7 o'clock Eastern for ACB Radio Interactive, another weekend of live DJs and music and fun. So stay tuned to ACB Radio over the week and the weekend. You can always be guaranteed of hearing something groovy. And that is it from me. Thank you very much for your calls. I sort of had this worry that we might not get too many calls as a result of the presidential debate, but we had enough to do a program. Thank you to my guests once again, Rosemary Kavanagh and Jerry Chevalier, for a fascinating discussion, and it's been a pleasure doing Blind Line for you. No Blind Line next week, unfortunately, due to other commitments, but we'll be back in a fortnight, in 2 weeks' time, for more. Bye for now.